some Christmas tree. Yes, I'm gonna hang my sock high on some Christmas tree.
I'm coming home today. I'm gonna hold her close this Christmas and never stray away. Cause it's so sad and lonely when my baby's far from me. I'm gonna meet her tonight beneath the Christmas tree. I'm gonna grab you Christmas morning.
Don't you ever let me go.
And by New Year's morning, baby,
I won't be blue no more.
Cause it's so sad and lonely when my baby's far from me.
I'm gonna meet you tonight
beneath the Christmas tree.
Christmas week. Why? I can't see. He left me Christmas week. Why? I can't see. leave all these babies crying, crying out their wishes to me. Not a turkey on the yard, not a chicken in my frigidaire. Not a turkey on the yard, not a chicken in my frigidaire. That man, what he left us, don't seem like he care. But that's all right, babies will be grown someday. Some wants dolls, some wants ducks, some want trucks, clothes to wear to school. That's all right. He's trying to play me for a fool. But we don't have to cry no more. There's a big fat Sandy walking in my front door.
Time is coming now, baby. Tell me though, Santa Claus gonna come to you. Whoa, you know Christmas time is coming now. Tell me though, Santa Claus gonna come to you. You know I'm gonna send it myself, darling. I'm gonna bring you a present and do a little thing that you may want me to. Old Santa Claus had a bill in his hand. Yes, you know I went down in New York City. I saw Santa Claus. He was standing there with a bell ringing in his hand. Why, you know the poor children were running up, hollering, "Are you gonna come to me, Sammy?" He said, "Little girl, please put something in old Santa's hand." Whoa, ain't it happy to see these old people learning the young one? Yeah, just learning them exactly what to do. So sweet to see these old people learning the young children just what to do. Mother said a many years ago, Santa Claus come to me. Now this year he gonna come to you. my little sister said, take your stocking now. Hang it up on the head of the bed. Talking to a friend, she said, take your stocking. And please hang it up on the head of the bed. He said, you know, we all got essentials. In the morning, old Santa Claus gonna see that we all is fit.
Title of this song is Christmas Time Once Again. Once again, baby, let me bring you a present tonight. Yes, it is Christmas time once again. Darling, let me bring your present tonight. I just wanna be your Santa Claus, even though if all my whiskers ain't white. Don't be late hanging up your stocking, because old Santa Claus, he is on his way. Yes, darling, don't be late hanging up your stocking, because old Santa Claus, he is on his way. Christmas Eve night, he coming down your chimney. Fill your stocking full before Christmas Day. Y'all know old Santa Claus, he had to work all alone, you know. Yes, darling, you had a whole year to get ready. You know Christmas here don't come but once a year. I sure don't want you to be surprised. Wake up Christmas morning, find out old Santa been here. Yeah. holiday. That is one holiday you should never forget. Yes, out of all of the holidays, darling, that's one holiday you should not never forget. Because you know, if I hadn't played Santa Claus, I don't see how we both could have met. Yes, if I hadn't played Santa Claus, I don't see how both we could meet.
To the sea, sitting right out a window blind. My baby got a little toast for sea, sitting right out a little window blind. Why, she got lights on a tree, boy, shine miles around. Christmas, you didn't have nothing left to receive from me. You're not in first cause my baby, you didn't have nothing left to receive from me. I want you to tell me what the fault that you find a poor old man. I just want you to tell me, baby, what the fault that you find a poor old man. Cause I've been 15 years, baby, on this cousin you didn't have that on that tree for me. You know this your birthday, I'm giving it to you on a Christmas Eve. My parents and dad, you know today your birthday, and I'm giving it to you on a Christmas Eve. I said, babe, all I want you to do something to get my poor heart in.
Lord have mercy.
make it sweet now.
My baby, she fell up in my home. She said, Daddy, you about to make me moan. My baby fell up in my home. She said, Daddy, you about to make me moan. She said, you done got mad with me, 'cause ain't nothing on that Christmas tree for you.
Now with the Christmas tree.
Christmas tree. could have a real good time. Baby, just you and me.
Everybody, let's go home. Uh-huh. Santa Claus. Yeah, this is Christmas. Baby, will you be my Santa Claus? If you be my present woman, I won't love no one else at all.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the New York Times says that Amnesty International recently became the first major international human rights organization to accuse Israel of carrying out genocide in Gaza. That makes sense only if you ignore the other human rights groups and international bodies that have said Israel's actions in the wake of Hamas attacks on October 7th, 2023, meet that definition. The Times account notes that genocide is hard to prove because it involves showing the specific intent to destroy a group in whole or in part, something that they say Israeli leaders have persistently denied is their intent in Gaza. Declarations like that by Israeli President Isaac Herzog that it is an entire nation out there that is responsible appear nowhere in the piece. The Times tells readers that Amnesty's contention and similar allegations have been, quote, at the heart of difficult debates about the war around the world, close quote. Well, so far, 14 countries have joined or signaled they will join South Africa's genocide case against Israel in the World Court. Gallup polling from April found the majority of the U.S. public, 55%, up from 45% last November, saying they disapprove of Israel's siege of Gaza. That support for Israel is dropping among all political affiliations. A May survey from a private Israeli think tank says nearly a third of Jewish people in the U.S. agree with the charge of genocide, and 34% view college campus protests as anti-war and pro-peace, compared with 28% who see them as primarily anti-Israel. More recently, the Israel Democracy Institute reports its survey from late November, finding that the majority of Jewish people in Israel, 52%, oppose settlement in Gaza versus 42% in support. There is absolutely debate around the world about Israel's actions. Outlets like the New York Times make that debate more difficult by misrepresenting it. While not the first to ask us to see the assault on Palestinians as genocide, Amnesty's report offers an opening for those journalists who are interested to ask why some are so invested in saying that it isn't. Iman Abid is the director of advocacy and organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. We talk with her today. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. In September 2023, California passed a law requiring fast food restaurants with more than 60 locations nationwide to pay workers a minimum of $20 per hour, affecting more than 700,000 people working in the state's fast food industry. Listeners will be unsurprised to hear that corporate media told us all that that would devastate the industry. As Connor Smythe reported for Fair.org, before the law went into effect, outlets like USA Today and CBS were telling us that due to efforts to help those darn workers, going to McDonald's or Chipotle is going to cost you more and also force people out of work. This past April, Good Morning America doubled down with a piece about the stark realities and the burdens that restaurants would now face due to the law. Well, now we have actual data about the impact of California's law. The SHIFT project assessed the impact and did, quote, not find evidence that employers turn to understaffing or reduced scheduled work hours to offset increased labor costs, close quote. Instead, weekly work hours stayed about the same for California fast food workers, and levels of understaffing appeared to ease. Furthermore, there was no evidence that wage increases were accompanied by a reduction in fringe benefits, such as health or dental insurance, paid sick time, or retirement benefits. In June of this year, the California Business and Industrial Alliance ran a full-page ad in USA Today claiming that the fast food industry cut about 9,500 jobs as a result of the $20 minimum wage. Well, that's just false, says Popular Information. Among other things, that ad relied on a report from the Hoover Institute itself, based on a Wall Street Journal article from a period before the new wage went into effect, and that was not seasonally adjusted. There's an annual decline in employment at fast food restaurants from November through January, when people are traveling or cooking at home, which is why the Bureau of Labor Statistics offers seasonally adjusted data. That industry group ad started with Rubio's, which they said was forced to close 48 California locations due to increasing costs. It left out that the entire company was forced to declare bankruptcy after it was purchased by a private equity firm. As Smythe reports, there is extensive academic research on the topic of wage floors that shows that minimum wage hikes tend to have little to no effect on employment, while they do raise the wages of hundreds of thousands of workers. Media's elevation of anecdotes about what individual companies have done or say they plan to do in response to the minimum wage hike overshadows more meaningful information about the net effect across all companies in the industry. And then what about agency? The Wall Street Journal contended that, quote, it defies economics and common sense to think that businesses won't adapt by laying off workers, close quote, in response to the need to raise the minimum wage. But why is that? Is there no question lurking in there about corporate priorities, about executive pay, about the fact that consumers and workers are the same people? The question calls for thoughtfulness. Will, for example, fast food companies cut corners by dumping formerly in-house delivery workers off on entities like DoorDash and Uber Eats, which are not subject to the same labor regulations? How will economic data measure that? That would be a story for news media to engage if they were interested in improving the lives of struggling workers. They could also broaden the debate around the minimum wage discussion to complementary policy changes like expanded unemployment insurance, the earned income tax credit, a job guarantee, or universal basic income. The narrow focus on whether a Big Mac is going to cost 15 cents more, and if it does, shouldn't you be mad at the people behind the counter? It's a distortion and a tired one that should have been retired long ago. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Quote, Amnesty International's report demonstrates that Israel has carried out acts prohibited under the Genocide Convention with the specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza, close quote. So says Agnes Callamard, Secretary General of that human rights group. She says research shows that Israel has persisted in committing genocidal acts, fully aware of the irreparable harm it was inflicting. Amnesty's statement invokes an international community that will hopefully be roused to action. But there are questions about what levers of power that community has access to and what it means that many or most of that community receive our understanding from elite news media, not just about what's happening, but about possible responses and about what the law even means in this context. Iman Abid is the director of advocacy and organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Iman Abid.
Thank you so much.
Well, genocide isn't a slur or an accusation that you just throw at people that you don't like. There are definitions. And what Amnesty is saying is that those criteria are being met. So can you talk us through how this report, and it's not the first report, but how and why does it arrive at the conclusion of genocide?
Yeah, I mean, I want to acknowledge the fact that we are 14 months into this genocide and have heard the word genocide being used to describe the situation in Gaza by not just human rights organizations, but the people themselves in Palestine and many elected officials and different international institutions, such as the International Criminal Court, that have been used to, you know, using the word genocide to help describe the situation. And so the fact that we are at this position now where this internationally renowned human rights organization like Amnesty International is also now joining the ranks and claiming this as genocide is hugely profound and necessary. I think one of the things that they do a profound job in this report particularly is highlighting the fact that this thing that's going on right now is something that meets the entire set of criteria to describe genocide within the Geneva Convention, mm-hmm. whether it be genocidal intent, whether it be the deliberate killing of a certain ethnic and cultural population, whether it be the prevention of placement of children, whatever it is that's going on is happening here in Gaza. And the report does a profound job in helping construct just why they are making this claim. And not just of the fact that this is a once-in-a-time-making sort of thing, but rather this has been continuing. This has continued for 14 months and will continue if no one chooses to stop it. And so I think throughout the entire report, they do a beautiful job to help folks understand just why specifically this is happening, what specific intent is behind the Israeli government in, you know, this military plan that they have on Gaza, as well as the personal harm that has been committed against thousands and thousands of Palestinians over the course of these last 14 months. And it goes so detailed into describing the personal and bodily harm to people, the amount of deaths that have been committed, the destruction of the infrastructure that people have used to stay alive, the prevention of aid, and specifically life-saving aid to keep people alive. Israel is doing everything in its ability to prevent people from actually living in Gaza. And Amnesty is trying to build a case that because of those things and because of the criteria it meets within the Geneva Convention, this is in fact genocide and it is not disputable, but rather it is time to acknowledge what is going on, look at the facts and the findings of what we've seen. And in many cases, actually, Israel has almost presented to the public itself and to look at everything that's been live streamed over the course of these last 14 months and do everything in our power to try to stop it. So I think, again, 200 pages of findings and documentation that I think many folks can actually look back on and say, my God, like I actually saw this on social media at one point or another, or I've heard this specifically come from the Israeli government's testaments and testimonials, and recognize that this is in fact something that we have been undergoing now for the last 14 months.
Well, and the ongoing commission of the crime is part of what's being talked about. Often when we think of crime and the way that crime is covered in the media, it's a one-time act. And so mm-hmm. you can think, well, the perpetrator, what was in their mind when this one-time act occurred? This is not that. This is a different right. kind of conversation. And I think that's an important distinction for folks who are just kind of reading about it in the paper as like a bad thing that's happening.
Exactly. I think that's something that Amnesty has been trying to do. And I want to acknowledge as well, many other human rights experts have been trying to do in this moment,
right.
is to show that this isn't something that just happened after October 7th, that this has deliberately been extended to happen and continue to happen until all Palestinians are annihilated across Gaza.
Well, and the report, it answers a lot of questions that you might just have in a conversation, you know, with your uncle or with a stranger. Is this just callous disregard? You know, Israel has a goal. They want to destroy Hamas, and they're not paying enough attention to civilians that are harmed. in their carrying out of that process. And this engages that and says, no, this is genocidal intent. It's not just recklessness.
Exactly. I think that's the thing, is that what we've seen happen is that Israel is trying to prove to the rest of the world that this is in fact not genocide, that this is out of self-defense. But the reality is that so many of the comments have been outlined here in the report and, you know, again, have been available to us just on an everyday basis. Is the reality is that Israel itself has actually built the case for us and arguing that this is in fact genocide. They have used statements to try to dehumanize Palestinians, and it's all Palestinians, not just those, you know, that have been involved in anything, but like the fact that all Palestinians are in some way or another, just due to who they are, should be dehumanized. And I think that that is an argument that they've been trying to make to help legitimize the mass killings of Palestinians. There are statements that have been made to completely disregard all human life in Palestine, all across Gaza, and even the West Bank, to be able to kind of, again, legitimize this forcible displacement, to legitimize the prevention of life-saving aid, to legitimize the bombing of residential buildings, to legitimize why they're bombing hospitals and claiming that Hamas, for instance, has tunneled underneath hospital ground. They're trying to do everything in their ability to try to legitimize these killings and dehumanize Palestinians as though they are these military targets, not actually, you know, dignified as everyday people, just so that the rest of the world is convinced of why Israel has the right to do this. And again, going back to the Amnesty report, it highlights just how this is beyond a military operation, has been intentionalized to try to use this moment and leverage this moment as a way to continue killing as many Palestinians as possible.
Well, and I wish it didn't need saying, but I'll say it. This report, as with other reports, acknowledges crimes committed by Hamas on October 7th, 2023. To say that those crimes are being ignored or being devalued is simply false. It's just about the conversation of whether they justify what came after and whether they should be seen in a context of what came before. Well, when media talk about the U.S. and Israel and their mutually beneficial relationship, I always think, well, which U.S. citizens, you know, which even Israeli people are you telling me are individually benefiting? You know, media treat nations like kaiju, like Godzilla, like there are monsters that represent countries and fight one another. And to me, that's a big failing in terms of representing what the U.S. people believe and want and are capable of, and also what Israeli people want and are capable of. And that's before we talk about ignoring the voice of Palestinians. There's just a crudeness of the media coverage that is harmful, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, again, the fact is that for the last 14 months, we as Palestinians, and even as a Palestinian-led organization here at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, have been trying to do our best to ensure that people do hold to account the Palestinian narrative and the framing around what is happening. Israel's propaganda system is enormous, mm-hmm. and it's very effective. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen just how media outlets kind of go around saying the same exact thing that has now been used to legitimize this genocide. You know, rather than arguing the fact that it is genocide, we're now trying to defend ourselves against the fact that this isn't genocide.
Right.
Or that people, defend ourselves against the people who are saying this isn't genocide. And I think that it's because of the fact that media has done such an incredible job at passing along statements that this is warranted because of the October 7th attacks, that it's as if the Palestinian people deserve this because of the October 7th attacks. But in reality, it's long before October 7th and continues to happen after October 7th that this level of detriment to Palestinian civil society has existed, and Israel has done everything in its power to make these things happen. You know, I acknowledge the fact that in this moment, we, I think, are seeing a shift in the way that people are actually talking about this. I think that Western news outlets have been forced now to at least acknowledge that there is this mass atrocity happening, whether or not they choose to use the word genocide is still a question to some degree. But I think that when reports like this get publicized, going back to the Amnesty International report, the hope is here we can then acknowledge the fact that this report does the news that has even the word genocide in its title, right? To the point that it has to be referenced. It has to be acknowledged. Now, we know that there are people who go so far as still choosing to refute the 200 pages of evidence and documentation, but we know that that can only go so far. So I think that 14 months in, we're starting to see a small shift, but I think the reality is there's lots more work to do around it. And my hope is that reports like this can be used as a way to justify just why we're calling it as it is, and choosing not to actually try to continue using statements or saying statements that can continue legitimizing just what's happening. Because the rhetoric we use, and especially that journalists use here in the West, is extremely harmful. And it's not just dehumanizing to the people in Gaza. It's actually dehumanizing the Palestinians here in the West as well. I mean, so much so that a lot of what's been heard on media has been used as a way to warrant hate crimes against Palestinians here in the U.S.
Right.
And I think we saw that happen over the course of the last year. Just, you know, a young 6-year-old boy was killed in the Chicago area. A young Palestinian girl was slashed in the throat. That language is extremely violent and can be used to justify this level of hate against a certain group of people. Again, not just in Palestine, but here across the West for Palestinians themselves as well.
Well, Israel's official response, as I see it so far in U.S. media, is really not to address the substance, but to say Amnesty International is, quote, deplorable and fanatical, close quote. So then the way that we know that media choose to use a binary framing, us versus them, he said, she said, so it's not even... Let's look at the substance here. It's just, oh, consider the source. You know, some people think Amnesty is a fanatical organization. But I hear you saying that there are hopeful spaces in terms of media coverage and in terms of this report pushing through in the narrative.
Absolutely. I mean, even trying to debate whether or not Amnesty is legitimate or not, like, still forces the conversation on genocide to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What Israel is doing right now is forcing this conversation and even using the word genocides and creating this battle out of it that starts to make more people start to question, well, just why is it that this international human rights organization has put out such a report, right, at this moment? And it's been used as a vehicle to try to prevent these things from continuing across Gaza, right? Like, Amnesty is trying to do, in their best ability, to try to actually put something out there that can be used as a way to help us stop sending weapons to Israel, to stop sending military funding to Israel, to stop us from being complicit in this genocide here in the U.S., and to encourage even more elected officials to take that stance, as well as to use this as a vehicle to help explain to the American public audience, that those are still on the fence around what is happening, that there is a clear set of documentation, evidence, proof, whatever you want to call it, to help describe the situation that they can then use to convince more people, right? Like, I think the American public has actually been shifted mm-hmm. dramatically over mm-hmm. the course of this last year. We saw 70% of American voters are in agreement with the fact that this genocide does need to end.
Right.
And that the fact is that we know that number continues to grow as people have seen things escalate. And I think we want to continue seeing that happen. We want to continue educating people and doing all of that. This is not the first time Israel has tried to delegitimize a human rights organization, right? Like, let's not forget the fact that there are a number of other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Amnesty has already been counteracted by the Israeli government in the past. And I think that the reality is every time Israel sees this level of documentation and evidence being put out there, they're going to refute it. And so for me, it's like, if Israel has to go out of its way, especially if the Israeli government has to go out of its way to try to delegitimize a report like this, recognize the legitimacy of the actual reporting at this point and use that as a way to kind of encourage yourself to learn more about the situation and see just why these sorts of organizations are really putting this information out there.
Well, I'll just ask you finally, we know that the political system in this country, the corporate media, atomize us and tell us that really there isn't anything that we can do. We can just kind of watch the horror on TV. You have a Stop Gaza Genocide Toolkit. You have information on your site to help folks actually go beyond being horrified and depressed and get engaged. And I just wonder what you've started to say it, but what would you say to folks who want to take a next step?
Yeah. And thank you for these sorts of questions. I want to first acknowledge the fact that even as we were speaking today, only a couple of hours ago, a residential building in Bit Lahia was struck.
Right.
And over 30 people were killed, right? And this is right next to a hospital that has already been deprived of receiving life-saving aid to keep people alive. It doesn't have enough units in the hospital to keep newborn babies alive. The reality is that this report and everything we've just spoken of on the segment today is not part of the past. It's a part of what is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder to us that this matter is urgent and needs to be addressed immediately. And I think that folks, you know, as we're entering the holidays, as we're entering the end of the year, people just want to turn a blind eye and forget the fact that this is continuing. But it is continuing, and it will intensify the more we look away. And so for anyone, recognize the fact that even your U.S. tax dollars are being paid to invest in this genocide. So what are you going to do about it? We have toolkits and resources to help make people more aware as to how that money is being invested in this genocide. And there are opportunities and avenues to actually divest from this money from continuing to fund this genocide. There are avenues out there, and we really hope folks can check out our website to figure out ways in which you can get involved in that divestment piece. If you are someone who cares enough about changing the stance the U.S. Congress has on this, as we know that they have continued to send military aid, even as President Biden closes his legacy out, he is choosing to still send weapons and funding to Israel to continue committing the genocide. What are you going to do about it? So we ask both people that are part of the civil society here in the U.S. to ask their elected officials to stop sending weapons and to be public around choosing not to continue sending weapons, even into the Trump administration. We ask folks to continue doing that. There are so many avenues in which we can actually play a role as to stopping this from happening, whether it's even putting this, you know, report out in front of your families across the holidays. We really encourage folks to use this as an opportunity to convince even more people in their surroundings to acknowledge just what's going on and to remind ourselves that Gaza in particular right now in this moment really does need the help to stop this from continuing to happen. And we in the U.S. play a huge role in making sure that we're not complicit in this genocide. So people have a positionality that they can take, and there's a moral choice here still. And we really hope that folks can continue doing everything that they can to get this to stop, because there is an opportunity for us to really make this stop.
We've been speaking with Iman Abid from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. You can find their work and their resources online at uscpr.org. Thank you so much, Iman Abid, for joining us this week on Counterspin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades of shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. FAIR.org is also the place to show much-needed support for Counterspin if you're able and so inclined, and we thank you. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, few corporations have changed the U.S. business and consumer model more than Amazon. So when that corporate behemoth buys one of the country's national papers, it's a conflict writ large. But things as they are, reporting on Amazon has, in general, looked more like representing that conflict than confronting it. Good Jobs First monitors mega companies like Amazon and their impact on our lives. Their database notes more than $2.4 billion in misconduct penalties for Amazon since 2010. The most expensive of those fines are about the company's anti-competitive practices, but the most frequent offenses are related to cheating workers out of wages and jeopardizing their health and safety. Arlene Martinez is Deputy Executive Director and Communications Director at Good Jobs First. We'll talk to her about the effort to make Amazon pay. Also on the show, a few years back, Amazon dangled the prospect of locating a headquarters in New York City, and the city offered some $3 billion of tax breaks and subsidies to entice them. The deal fell through for various reasons, one of which was informed community.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRC.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The death penalty is not in keeping with who we are as the United States. We are better than that. Thank you, President Biden, for following your faith and standing up for justice.
In a historic move, President Biden spares the lives of almost all 37 of 40 men on death row Monday by commuting their sentences to life without parole, just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House with a promise to restart and expand federal executions. We'll speak to two activists leading the call to abolish the death penalty, Sister Simone Campbell and Herman Lindsay, who spent 3 years on Florida death row before being exonerated. He's now executive director of Witness to Innocence. Then to the damning House Ethics Report on former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, Trump's first pick for attorney general before he was forced to withdraw from consideration.
What struck me most was that the committee found substantial evidence that Gaetz paid thousands and thousands of dollars to women for sex and illicit drugs over a three-year period. Again, the drugs for himself, including ecstasy, marijuana, and for the women as well.
Then we look at what the toppling of the Assad regime means for the Kurds of Syria, as Turkey, Israel, and the United States all vie for greater control.
Turkey is just pushing all the buttons to exterminate Kurds from Syria and from Syria's future negotiations, from attacking to cooperating with HDS to reaching out to the world leaders to take the Syria's Kurds out of the question. Turkey is a big threat to Rojava and to northeast Syria at the moment.
We'll speak with Kurdish professor Özlem Konen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say Israel's attack the Al-Auda and the Kamel Adwan hospitals in northern Gaza while forcing wounded and sick patients to leave the Indonesian hospital in the latest assaults on Gaza's devastated health system. Israeli artillery shelled the third floor of the Al-Auda hospital while Israel detonated remote-controlled explosives just outside Kamel Adwan, which is barely functioning after repeated Israeli attacks. This is Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, director of Kamel Adwan, speaking on Al Jazeera.
Just now, one of the explosives planted by the Israeli army detonated. It caused a shockwave that shattered the hospital doors and windows on the west side. It also injured some of the patients and the very few medical staff left at the hospital. Roughly 20 people were hurt. A second, stronger explosion followed. It caused massive damage to the hospital's west wing, and more patients were injured. The entire west wing's doors and windows were all smashed, and the false ceiling collapsed.
At the United Nations, officials decried Israel's attacks on Gaza's health system.
The Director General of the World Health Organization said that the reports of bombardment near Kamal Adwan Hospital and orders to evacuate the hospital are deeply worrisome, adding that the hospital has been in the middle of fighting for too long and the lives of patients are at risk. OCHA reiterates that civilians